This is Parenting for the Everyday, a podcast dedicated to meeting parents in the trenches of parenthood. We explore how our faith fits into our parenting. With the help of our guests, we are seeking practical tips on how the gospel can speak into our day-to-day parenting. From the easy stuff to the hard stuff, we want to talk about it all. This is Parenting for the Everyday. I'm Becca Alvarez.
And I'm Holly Dykandrew.
And today, I am so excited about this episode. We are talking about ADHD, and we have two fabulous guests in our studio. I am super excited about this topic just because I feel like there's so much misinformation out there. And so I'm super pumped to hear about it. Our guests, will you guys introduce yourselves?
Yeah, I'm Christina Hallwarda. I am a licensed independent social worker. I'm a clinician. I work here at the church through the Center for Care doing counseling with children and adolescents. I'm married to my husband, Mike, and we have three kids. We have a 7-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 7-month-old today.
7 months. Yeah. Oh, she's 7 months today.
Today.
Oh, fun.
I'm Liberty York. I am a student at Case Western Law School and 29, kind of old, but still a student.
Not old.
And
we're not all giving our ages.
Yeah, not old. That's not the best way to start out, but I am a person with ADHD. So
yeah, I am also really, really excited about this episode for a couple reasons. I think you hit it on the head when you said there's a lot of misinformation. And so I think we're trying to figure out what's fact, what's fiction, what's real, what's not. I'm a mom of a kid who has ADHD. And so I have learned so much of that in my journey and also been met with probably some difficulties. And that misinformation has negatively impacted my home. And so I'm just excited to learn as a parent and then to also help parents understand their own kids or kids that they come in contact with. Liberty, you and I have had conversations. Just you've been able to help me personally and say, hey, this is what helped me as a person living with ADHD. So I'm excited to dive into that. But let's probably start with the basics and say, what does it actually mean to have ADHD? And Christina, you're probably the best to hit us off with that.
Sure. Yeah. So when we're talking about diagnosing, we are using the DSM, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And we're in the 5th edition. So that was published or last updated in 2013. And in the DSM, the ADHD is under this umbrella category of neurodevelopmental disorders. So that means that it began in childhood. So the DSM specifies that symptoms have to be present before age 12. And it's neuro, it's brain-based, which is really important. But I'll come back to that more in a minute. So with diagnosing, all of the diagnostic criteria is behavioral because we need something that's seen and measurable. So there are two different main behavioral categories, and then there are 4 qualifiers. So the first behavioral category is the AD side of things. It's the attention deficit. And so that has 9 symptoms associated with it. And it's things like difficulty sustaining attention, wandering off task, being forgetful or losing things, difficulty organizing tasks, things like that. And then the other behavioral criteria is the hyperactive impulsive criteria, and that also has 9 symptoms associated with it. And so that's things like excessive motor activity in inappropriate settings, which basically is
like
just
fidgeting.
Yeah, well, okay. Excessive fidgeting is okay. A separate one,
okay.
But it'd be like, okay, you know, having a hard time sitting in a chair for a long period of time or climbing when it's not appropriate to be climbing on something, excessive fidgeting, interrupting or intruding on others, things like that. I'm trying to think of other ones, but there's 9 of those. And so in order to get a diagnosis, you have to exhibit 6 of the 9 symptoms and 1 and or other criteria. So you can have 6 symptoms in the inattentive type, but you don't necessarily have to have them in the hyperactive impulsive type. You can have one or the other. So like in the DSM-5, ADD was eliminated. ADD no longer exists as a diagnosis. It's now just ADHD inattentive type, or you can be ADHD hyperactive type, or you can be ADHD combined type.
Because just so I'm understanding, so the ADD was a diagnosis used for the same thing, but without the hyperactivity part. It's saying, hey, the same neurosymptoms exist, but it's not present in hyperactivity.
Correct. It was just attention deficit disorder.
Okay.
But then there's four qualifiers. So you have to have, it has to be consistent. So it has to be every day, all day. It has to be persistent. So it has to have started in childhood, right, before age 12, and then continuous all the way through present day. It has to be pervasive. So it has to be in more than one setting. So the DSM identifies like four different domains. There's home, there's social, which would be like home or friends, school, and occupational. At work. So it has to be in at least two different settings. And then most importantly, it has to have a significant impairment on your functioning. So it has to be like interfering with your daily life and daily like responsibility somehow. So that's the diagnostic criteria. So it's all behavioral. However, it's really important to remember that ADHD is brain-based, right? So the origin of the behaviors is neurological. So it's not characterological. It's not like a lack of discipline or a matter of will. It starts neurologically. So if you have ADHD, the way that your brain functions and thinks is different than someone who does not have ADHD. It is a condition of the nervous system.
How do you distinguish between the two? So for instance, like for me, how could I tell this is neurological or this is like without a diagnosis? Like if I was a parent and I was saying, man, I have a kid who doesn't listen. How do I know if it is I should see someone to maybe see a diagnosis or if it's just a discipline behavioral issue?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I think like that's where the diagnostic criteria comes in, like where it kind of gives those like four qualifiers, like needs to be constant, it needs to be persistent, pervasive, like all of those things. So I think as a parent, if you're trying to think through those things, I think I would start with trying to do like different behavioral interventions before you would jump to, oh, this must be an ADHD diagnosis.
Okay. That makes sense.
I think there is a cognition side of symptoms. They're just not involved in the diagnosis. So things like, hold on, I need to look.
While you're looking, I just think it's, those qualifiers are so important and so interesting because I do think, I love what you said, Christina, as far as like it's not a discipline thing, because I think when you are neurotypical, it's easy to look at someone that is not and feel like, well, just focus. Like I have a hard time focusing too. It's hard for me to write this paper. But if your brain is working normally, and maybe it's hard for you to write that paper in that moment, but you can focus on everything else later on. I love that persistent and pervasive part of it because you can have a hard time focusing in school and focus super well on the soccer field or in sports, and that could be an indication that you don't have ADHD. You know what I mean? Yep. I just think that it's so important to know the diagnosis before you're
something you can just will assuming, yourself correct. To do differently.
Right. Yeah. So I think what I would kind of add to that is as I was preparing for this, I watched a webinar by a psychologist named Dr. William Dodson, and he talked about this concept of interest-based performance, which basically says that your mood, your energy, your performance is solely determined, if you have ADHD, is solely determined by your momentary engagement with the task at hand. And whereas a neurotypical person would think in terms of importance and reward, someone with ADHD thinks or is motivated or able to engage based off of interest, challenge, novelty, so like something being new or creative, and urgency. And so if you think about those things, as a parent, right, if you're like kind of playing this out, you can think about like, okay, procrastination, right? A lot of times someone with ADHD will struggle with procrastination because you need the sense of urgency in order to allow you to engage, get access to your skills, and then see it through to completion. Or frequently, and I'm sure, you know, you can speak to this too, Liberty, is people with ADHD are able to get very hyper-focused on things and can have relentless determination, but it requires that you're either interested in it, you're challenged, it's novel, or it's urgent in order for you to do that. But you can see, like, there are certain things where someone with ADHD has an incredible working memory around it or can stay so honed in and laser vision on it. And I think sometimes that can get confusing because you're like, why can you do that here? But you can't do that when it comes to school.
We call it a, we call it a superpower in our house.
Yes.
It's like, hey, yes. you can all of a sudden be super engaged and just attentive, and we know you're going to excel in that, but it's like you're locked in and that's like your superpower.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And so treatment wise, like that is the goal of medication with ADHD, is to help someone who has ADHD be able to get in the zone when the situation demands it, not having it have to meet one of those other four criteria. Yeah.
Christina, you mentioned that the goal of medication is to get people that have ADHD kind of in that zone. Would you say that medication always has to be present with ADHD, with people that have ADHD, or are there different coping mechanisms that you can develop?
Or maybe even different levels of ADHD that would need medication?
Yeah, there's definitely severities. Like even within a diagnosis, you will have like mild, moderate to severe. So it's on a spectrum. And I think Liberty can also probably speak to this. Like as you age, ADHD will always be present. You don't outgrow it. But the way it interferes or the way that you experience it changes. So I think I wouldn't say you always need medication. The heart of like non-medication treatment is to help someone with ADHD learn how to build skills in order to get themselves to engage, even if it's not one of those four criteria. But if it is more severe, then I would say you do need medication.
Okay, so Liberty, so everybody can't see you, but you're nodding like this is hitting home, like you're relating. So like tell us, when you hear Christina say this is what's typical in ADHD, are you like, yes?
Yeah, it's really funny because I look back because I was diagnosed as an adult. I look back on my childhood and it's just like, oh, it's so funny because it's like every single thing except the hyperactivity part. I've always been like a very stationary person. but even now with I'm in law school and have very large projects, I have to wait till 12 hours before it's due or I can't do it. My mind cannot focus in. And I'm very, very good at that. And I've kind of this is from my experience. It may not be like the best strategy, but I kind of determined when I was younger that it was okay that I left it till that 12 hours because that is when I work best. And trying to force myself into the box everyone else was in of like, oh, I gotta, you know, break this up into parts and get some done, you know, 7 days before, and then like it just didn't work for me, and I just kept wasting time and then getting upset and frustrated that I couldn't complete things the way everyone else did. And that it coming to that acceptance of, hey, if I can do it this way, there's nothing really wrong with doing it that way then. So it's interesting to hear everything you're saying and be like, yep, that's on point.
But it's you having to learn yourself and stop comparing and saying, okay, so for me to be able to complete this task well, these are the parameters in which I have to do it.
Yeah.
And not necessarily doesn't work for, you know, somebody else that would do it differently.
And just being okay that it looks different than everybody else. I actually, around 18, I developed pretty bad insomnia, and it was like off and on. I would have it for like several weeks to like maybe a couple months, and then it'd be gone for a few months and then come back. And as I got older, it was a little bit more and more difficult to deal with that. And so I ended up around like, I think I was 26. So I waited a long time, procrastinated on that as well. but it was becoming such like a negatively impacting thing on my everyday life that I was like, I've got to figure out why I cannot sleep. And so I went into my doctor and we did like sleep studies. He thought I had sleep apnea. And then finally he's like, okay, let's just talk about, which probably should have been the first thing, but let's talk about why do you think you can't sleep? And the key thing is I could not turn my brain off. At night I would be playing, believe it or not, Spider Solitaire in my head or Candy Crush. Like I couldn't turn it off. It wasn't me wanting to play. It's just I see these pictures and I'm moving everything around and I'm like, I cannot turn it off. And then I'm just awake for hours, not doing anything, like laying in the dark, not on my phone or something. And he said, I think you have ADHD. And I'm going to reveal my own bias and it's going to make me look a little bit bad. But I said, that's not possible. I was good in school.
Yeah.
And he laughed and said, okay, well, your bias is showing. You can be good in school and have ADHD. We went through a bunch of different, I guess, the criteria, him asking me a lot of different questions. And he said, I really do believe this is what you have. Why don't we try out some medication? We'll start a low dose first. And if it helps you, this is probably the diagnosis and there's nothing wrong with that. And it did. And it was the first day I took it, I can't even describe. It was one of the best days of my life because, like, I've always felt like I had 100 voices, not voices, like, voices, but voices in my head constantly, just all of this, like, noise. Mm-hmm. And then that first day that I took Adderall, which it makes me sound like I really love Adderall, but I did, because that first day I was like, is this what people always feel like? Because it's so peaceful in my head right now. It was like the best day of my life. So I wasn't upset with the diagnosis. I also didn't have, I think it's a lot different when you're a kid and people put that label on you and then you grow up with people creating expectations for you. I was already past that. So as an adult, I got to look back with this diagnosis and see, oh, all of these problems, or I like to kind of see it the way I did as a kid, which was the things that were air quotes wrong with me, they were strengths and weaknesses. That's how I've always tried to look at my life. If I'm not as good at something as everyone else, well, maybe I should become better at the things that I'm naturally good at to offset that. And that strategy kind of, it did help me, you know, be valedictorian. It helped me get into a really great law school. I have a master's degree. School did become something I was so good at, but it wasn't because I was like everyone else. It was because I accepted that I wasn't and that I could still compete on the level as everyone else with just a different strategy.
I really love that you did kind of break the bias, because I think that it's so common to think, like, if you have ADHD, it means that you're not good at school or that you can't be successful or some of those different stereotypes. And you broke all of those. You're in a law school. You have huge projects. Can you tell us some of the different things that you do proactively other than the 12 hour time? Mm-hmm. What are some other coping mechanisms that you do on the daily to help you with?
Mm-hmm. So, like I said before, I know I don't have to preface it every time, but this is from my experience. It's not going to work for everybody. I think that's one of the first things you do have to realize as a parent or as someone with ADHD, that I kind of think of it as failure is not actually failure. If you fail in the pursuit of success, it's not failure. It's kind of like how Thomas Edison said, like, I just learned 10,000 ways how not to make a light bulb. So I'm very I have a very positive relationship with failure, actually. I try to reframe the way I see things and, like, okay, I'm going to try 1,000 different things. And so I'd had a conversation with you, Holly, before about, you know, if I'm listening to a lecture, I'm playing a game. That's the reason I can play Spider Solitaire and Candy Crush in my head, because I do that all the time. I don't watch a movie and just watch a movie. I can't. My brain always has to be doing multiple things at once. I am not very good at listening in classes. That was something that people always had a problem with, because you're supposed to be a good listener. You're supposed to take good notes. I don't. I would rather read a book really quickly and know the information and be done with it and not have to, as I see it, waste my time. And so it's kind of my strategy was always, if I can become good at something, it doesn't matter if it looks bad. I want to say not looks bad, but kind of looks bad to other people, like, oh, you're not a good student. If I'm getting good grades, if I know what I'm doing, then I am a good student. So I've done things like I have something called Speechify. It's an app. And I take pictures of my book pages and I have it read it to me while I do something else. I do have a high auditory retention, so that is also very helpful. So listening to something, I can typically give it back to you pretty quickly. But just playing games, and I was never like a note card person. I didn't want to do that. Like, I'd record myself on my phone asking me questions, and then I'd listen to myself. It was a lot of me listening to myself. It might be a, you know, a bad sign. But yeah, I guess just like trying lots of different things and letting failure be an okay result, because as long as it's in that pursuit of, hey, let's figure this out, then it's a it's a good failure.
And yeah. I can't tell you how helpful that's been for me as a parent, because I remember the first time we talked and you would say like, hey, so in order for me to retain something auditory, I need to be doing something. So mm-hmm. it's like, I need to be playing solitaire and then listening to the lecture and I'm retaining it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, I would tell my kid, no, you have to you have a hard time focusing. So if you're doing something else, your focus is split. Mm-hmm. And so that was like, okay, wait. Let me be open to trying things that look different than a typical way to study. Like mm-hmm. I'm neurotypical. And so I would read my notes and I would study and then I could get the grade. And that's not how my child processes information. And so that has been just radically helpful personally to recognize it looks different for each kid. And what is the most helpful way for the way that they learn? Like my kid's really hands-on, so he's mm-hmm. a kinetic learner. He needs to be doing something, touching something, tactile. And so what seems as a distraction if he's bouncing a ball is actually helping him retain information. Mm-hmm. And so that has been really helpful to me as a parent.
It just seems like being willing to think outside the box and yeah. do things outside the box can be so helpful, especially with this particular disorder.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I love how proactive you are.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, oh, I can't sit and listen to a lecture, so I'm out. It's right. Okay, this isn't what works for mm-hmm. me. So what does work for me and how do I make my education work for me? Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the strengths in that is that I am very time efficient because I do not like the feeling that I'm wasting my time. Which that's why I can't listen to a lecture because I'm like, I could read this faster than this person's talking. I don't like to waste time. I want efficiency. And so in class, usually I'm doing something else. I'm doing some research on my computer that's not as accessible to like maybe a high school student or a middle school student. But I am doing something else because I don't want to waste that time. But I've also gravitated toward things that play to those strengths. My master's is in counterterrorism. A lot of that is a very quick analysis. So you're doing very fast research and you're getting out an analysis product to be given to like someone in the government. I mean, that's how they train you. And those are here, you have one night to do this, get it done. That plays very well to my strengths. So kind of gravitating toward those things rather than, I guess, trying to just mimic everybody else. And I do think that it's a lot about self-correction. I think we actually naturally, if someone's not discouraging us from going toward our natural strength, we naturally gravitate toward it. So even like your son wants to play a game, that might actually work then. Because I do think you tend to lean toward that. But most people just try to, you know, make you like everybody else.
Well, I was just going to say, I think like that also plays into this whole concept of like neurodiversity, mm-hmm. right? And we've used the language already today of like neurotypical. Mm-hmm. And ADHD is a part of neurodiversity. And I think previously neurodiversity or neurodivergence was individual not fitting in mm-hmm. with societal norms. And the focus was on remediating deficits, where now it's an opportunity to embrace diversity mm-hmm. and to see how your unique abilities are strengths and make our community, our family, our workplace richer. Mm-hmm. And how do we leverage your strengths while also then building additional skills mm-hmm. or supports to thrive in the different settings that are needed? Mm-hmm. So I think it plays right into that.
Yeah, that was such a good point. And what I was going to say is just, we talked about ADHD showing up in many different places, in school and home and social, things like that. But I feel like school is where it is most obvious. And so with what your point just now, Christina, with neurotypical and neurodivergence, it is difficult, it seems like, for teachers to recognize when something is disobedience, when something is a coping strategy. And so when you were going through that, Liberty, mm-hmm. what was that experience like for you with teachers? Because if I'm a teacher and I see you doing something else and not listening mm-hmm. to a lecture, then I'm going to correct you. So tell us a little bit more about your experience. And then what would you recommend for parents who are maybe trying to advocate for their kids?
Mm-hmm. So this might not be very helpful because I do have a very unique school experience as well. I grew up going to very small private schools, and I went to like a Mennonite private school for many years. And so you had like 10 people or 10 students to a teacher. Okay. And it was very like one-on-one focused. But it was also, I was in like you had to finish, but go at your own pace work. That was very helpful to my natural inclination because my goal was let's get it done so that I'm done doing all this stuff that I think is a waste of time. However, now, so I can speak to this more now, I have very open conversations with all of my professors at school. I don't tell them I'm not paying attention to you. That's just a little like ego damaging. But I tell them like, hey, you know, I just want to be really open and honest with you. I do have a lot of difficulty sitting for a long period of time and paying attention. So in order to keep attention, I have to, you know, maybe do like a word search while I'm listening to you. Ask me a question. I can still answer it. Having really blunt and honest conversations about, hey, this is where I'm coming from, I think kind of softens the blow too and gives them realistic expectations. In high school, I was known to be a nonconformist kind of, I just don't really like rules person, still am that way. And actually, just recently, someone told me, very wise man said, sometimes you have to play by the rules. And you do. Sometimes not playing by the rules means you are going to fail in not a good way. And I think that I'm not a parent, so this might be harder for a parent, but letting someone face consequences for their strategy. I've had times when I turn something in and it is bad, or I don't turn it in on time, because this doesn't always work, but it helps you determine, okay, how do I make this work? Having honest and open conversations with teachers about, hey, like I said, I went to a lot of private schools, so there was a lot of bargaining. I would tell teachers like, hey, instead of doing this thing, I want to do this thing. Like, for instance, we had a lot of projects. I hated projects because they always took a long time. I'm like, can you give me a paper to write instead? Because I can write a paper really fast. I think teachers are actually really open to bargaining, especially if they don't feel like it's like, oh, I'm letting you be lazy. If they see it as like, hey, can we maybe try different things? If you have a good teacher, typically they are open to those conversations, because I think the end goal is for a student to just learn. So if they are, like, who cares how?
I think what I would add to that is if you do have an ADHD diagnosis, or if you believe you have an ADHD diagnosis and you want to find out if you do, if you are in, I guess maybe it's only in public schooling, but you can have access to either a 504 plan or an IEP for an ADHD diagnosis. And so within that, you can have strategic conversations with the school psychologist and then the teachers to say, hey, this is what we've recognized, this is what's helpful, and you can advocate. And it's a team effort to help advocate. And so you're doing it in a way where the, you know, professionals at the school are also saying, like, this is appropriate, I can't allow this, or I'm sorry, I can't allow that, what else are our options? But if the goal is always, how do we aid in education, and we are open to understanding that the way that you function and process and think is different, okay, let's talk about what's in your individualized education plan to make this work for you.
And just some practical, just some clarifying. So even if you go to a private school, your public school, the district that you live in, they're required to assess you and to write those 504 and IEP plans for you. And so that's what we do. And then we can take those plans and then the private school can implement them as well. So whether or not you are attending public school, those resources are available to you and are highly, highly helpful and recommended. So,
and if you think you need it, if you write a letter to your district, they have to assess you. Like, so if you're having difficulties, just know if you write a letter, the district has to assess you and it has to be done in a timely manner.
Yeah.
And I just want to emphasize too the importance of an actual diagnosis as opposed to a self-diagnosis. I think that with social media and so much talk of mental health, which I think is wonderful, it is really easy to self-diagnose and to think that that's equivalent of a professional diagnosis, and it's not. And I think that if you get a professional diagnosis, it can be so much more helpful moving forward. Christina, I have one more question for you.
Can I touch on that real
quick? Yeah, go ahead.
Just because I think misdiagnosis is very common, like whether it's self-diagnosed or I think it's not irregular to have a misdiagnosis, even if it's done professionally. I think that webinar I was talking about pointed out that in the DSM, there are like close to 300 mental disorders, and there's like 160 some symptoms, which means there's a tremendous amount of overlap between symptoms and like a condition. And so even if you think about some of the symptoms, behavioral symptoms associated with ADHD, or even some of the things that Liberty's talked about with, you know, your brain thinking continuously, like that could be true with anxiety, or fidgety, or having a hard time sitting still. If you're anxious, like all of that is going to manifest. Or I think trauma a lot of times gets misdiagnosed as ADHD, because if you've experienced trauma and you're living with trauma symptoms, I think that that can get misunderstood as an ADHD diagnosis. So I think it's important to make sure that if you're getting an ADHD diagnosis, the clinician is someone who's taking the time to tease out like the origin of some of the behaviors, and also ruling out that there's not like another differential diagnosis going on that's maybe playing into the symptoms that are manifesting.
If I could say something on that, I do agree 100%. And I am very thankful because I had an inquisitive doctor. It's not just like the first thing we went to. So I would agree. Like, I actually thought I was misdiagnosed with ADHD. So it was very cool to have a doctor that, you know, does ask a lot of questions and is interested in finding the real answer, not just the first one.
As we're finishing up, you guys have been so, so helpful. But what are things that you would recommend a parent to do to help their child that may experience ADHD?
I think the first thing I would say, this is more just like a message to parents, and to, especially I guess if you're an adult and you don't really have a parent supporting you and you've just been diagnosed, reframing. I think especially with an ADHD diagnosis when you're in like middle school or high school, is that it's like, oh, we have to get over this mountain. And it comes down to, oh, we just need to finish like school. We need to finish this year. We need to finish this semester up. And I think in strategizing as a parent, you need to think of it more like you're not trying to get over a mountain. You're trying to teach your kid to climb 100 mountains. Because it's not just this one goal that ends when they're 18. It's something they have to deal with like for the rest of their lives. And it doesn't work very well in a lot of different settings. I have had bosses that are like, hey, you're just not really a great employee. I've also had bosses that say, you're the best employee because you're good at these things. But really, I guess trying to help your kid reframe the fact that this isn't a negative thing. It's actually a very positive thing that you are different, and you should embrace that and find ways to impact the world in a good way and in a positive manner that doesn't require you to become someone else. But getting over those mountains, it's not going to look the same as everybody else. But understanding that the end goal isn't to get over one. The end goal is to teach your kids to figure out how to get over all of them.
Yeah, I love that. I think anytime something is strengths-focused is like really great. I think there's some practical tips for parents, you know, like things that are probably helpful for any child, but especially someone with ADHD, like having clear and consistent structure and routines, having visual reminders, like visual checklists or visual timers, having very clear expectations that you repeat regularly, things like that. But I also think like just a framework that I think can be helpful is to think about when you're interacting with your child, because I know as a parent, sometimes it can get frustrating to think about like, is this broken body or is this sinful nature, right? So like if you're working with your child and they're procrastinating, you're getting really frustrated, like is this because their brain is processing differently or is this because there's a sinful nature thing going on here? And I think that can be helpful for a couple of reasons. One, because it can change your like empathy in the situation, and it changes your approach, right? So if I say to my child, if they have ADHD, like, hey, go clean your room, and then I go upstairs 30 minutes later and nothing has happened, I'm frustrated. Like, I asked you, you disobeyed. Whereas instead, it could be like, hey, there's like 12 different mini tasks within this, and I don't have the capacity to break that down and organize it just yet. And so it's actually on the parent to say, oh, I didn't give the instruction in a way that will set my child up for success. So this isn't their sinful nature disobedience. This is their ADHD brain thinking differently. So I would then change, okay, all your clothes, put away the dirty ones into your hamper and the clean ones into your dresser, and then come find me and I'll give you your next step. So things like that, that I think can be really helpful. One more thing I would just throw out there really quickly, just to kind of throw on your radar, because ADHD is a condition of the nervous system, there's growing research and understanding of the connection between ADHD and sensory processing difficulties. And so, you know, that's a whole other conversation for another thing, but I just think it's helpful to at least make that known so that as a parent, you can look into that a little bit further, because it can help you understand strategies to help your child, like, either calm down if there's a quick mood change that's happening or a tantrum or a meltdown, or even within focusing, different strategies like, you know, weighted blankets or compression sheets for sleeping, because sleep disturbance is common with ADHD. So things like that, that would be an occupational therapist, but I think that's like just helpful information to kind of be aware of.
It's super, super helpful. Thank you guys so much. I feel like it's been such a fun episode to have both an expert and someone that is actively coping and figuring stuff out with ADHD. And so it's just been such a pleasure to have you guys here and to teach us so much. Learned so much.
This has been Parenting for the Everyday. Thanks for listening. Tune in next time.